Welcome to JGL Law For You. JGL Law For You is a podcast by lawyers, but not for lawyers only. On JGL Law For You, we will be discussing a wide array of topics to help you navigate the many legal processes, developments in the law, other current events, and how they may affect you, your family, or your business.
And today we're talking family law. Why are we talking family law? Because as of October 1, some very, very important changes were made to the laws here in the state of Maryland. And to help talk us through them, what they mean to you if you're potentially looking at divorce or a custody dispute with your spouse or significant other, is my partner and good friend, Chris Castellano. Welcome back, Chris.
Good morning, David. Good as always to be back.
Yeah, good to have you. So let's dive right into this. And we're talking about Maryland's new House Bill 1191, which I know has now come into effect under the Family Law Article Section 9-201. That's effective as of October the 1st, 2025. And let's start from the top and work our way down. Why is this important to people who are either thinking of or on the precipice of looking at a potential custody dispute?
Yeah, so 9201 is now the unquestionable backbone of custody cases in Maryland. It dictates, there's 16 factors that laid out, and we can go into them in more depth in a few, but they dictate exactly how the court's going to look at a custody case and how the court's going to rule on that custody case, because it dictates that the court must articulate its findings based on these factors. And so not only is it a way that we as attorneys have to approach the case from its very inception, but all the way to its conclusion by way of a court ruling. This is pretty seminal as far as a new law for custody cases.
Okay, so for custody cases before this law was passed, you know, how were they decided and how is it any different now?
They still utilize factors, right? We're all too aware of the Taylor factors, Taylor v. Taylor factors, and the Sanders and Montgomery County v. Sanders factors. And there was a litany of factors that we would all rely upon in order to establish and argue our custody cases. What's different now is that the legislature, Annapolis, took all those different collection of factors and they distilled them down to what I would say a greatest hits of factors, right? Is that there is factors 1 through 15, and I say that very specifically, factors 1 through 15 are basically your primary factors to look at when arguing a custody case. Number 16 is your kind of kitchen sink. It's the any other factor that the court wants to consider. But factors 1 through 15 are your definitive factors that we are now going to go through when arguing a custody case.
All right, so you're getting ready, you're thinking about looking at the potential, whether it's divorce, whether it's just a custody dispute, whatever it may be. And as a litigant, as someone who was a parent, let's say as a parent, that's a better word, what should I be thinking about in terms of what I'll need to help prepare my case, what my lawyer is going to need to help me so that I can maintain custody of my children?
Yeah, so I mean, you and I have had quite a few recordings, and one of the themes of my way of thinking is risk management, right? And I think that this is a perfect example of that. When a litigant, a potential litigant's looking at their case, their upcoming custody case that they know is coming down the pipeline, what they want to do is they're feeling ambitious. They look at these factors, even write them out and say, you know, where are my vulnerabilities? Where is it that I've got some type of exposure? Now, of course, that could be down to the Hollywoodized version of, do you have skeletons in your closet? And we could talk about that. But it's really analyzing, hey, is this factor going to go for me or is this factor going to go against me? Now, there's nothing in the new statute that says that there's 15 factors, you know, so if you have 8 and the other side has 7, then you win, right? There's nothing that says that. But it is a good way for you to look at these factors to say, this one is for me, or this one helps, or this one helps my argument, and these ones don't. And so maybe that's where you focus. That's where you focus your efforts.
It's almost sounding like chemistry class. You know, there's 15 factors and there's a 16th, which we'll talk about. You throw them into a beaker and then something comes out. I mean, it's not that scientific, is it? I mean, at the end of the day, we're not measuring what goes into a beaker in chemistry class. Whatever these factors are, and I want you to talk about them, they're still subjective to a great extent, are they not?
Yeah, and I love how you brought it up in the realm of what is empirical based, right? Wrong or right, I'm a very black and white guy. And I love it when there is a structure. You know, I've always had that reputation of being a rules guy. I love the rules. I love the structure of things. And you are right. Every single person that approaches things is going to have a bias. It's going to have a subjective view on things. But I think the intention here of this new law, 9201, is to try to minimize as much as possible the subjectivity and make it into a clear set factors that we analyze. And hopefully, when you have enough of these cases being decided under 9201, you establish a pattern, right? And while it's not as empirical as the scientific world, it nevertheless makes it that there is less variation that hopefully, and perhaps this is part of the Annapolis's thinking, there's, as a result, less appeals in custody cases.
So, and we're going to move back to the factors themselves, although we don't want to spend hours talking about 16 factors. But when a judge listens to a custody case now, at the conclusion of the testimony, at the conclusion of the trial, is that judge required to tick through these factors and say, this is what the evidence showed as to factor one, this is what the evidence showed as a factor two, and so forth?
Yes. In short, the answer is yes. 9201B says that the court shall articulate its findings on the record or in a written opinion, including the consideration of each factor listed in the subsection above, right? And so, and by the way, relative to 16, which is our kitchen sink, as well as any other factor that the court considers. So the short answer, yes, the court must go through and identify. Now, in my opinion, the effective rulings that we've had prior to this were the ones that articulated each of the Taylor and Sanders factors, right? And you would, I'm sure you agree with that. But again, that's this idea, right? We had rulings back in the past that didn't necessarily articulate all these findings, or the arguments themselves were a little bit, I want to say haphazard, or scattershot is a better way to say it. We're trying to make it a little more definitive, focused, clean, and maybe make the approaches more universal.
So when you talk, and folks, just so everyone knows, the two cases that Chris mentioned are cases that lawyers in Maryland have been leaning on for years in arguing that whatever result they were looking for was in the best interest of the children, at least insofar as their clients are concerned. So now what we're doing, right, Chris, is we've taken those factors, the language that was in both of those cases for the most part, and turned them into a statute that's really on two pages in the code, as opposed to having to read through 30, 40, 50 pages of a court opinion.
Yeah, I love going through my cases, and what I tell my clients is making them anticlimactic. And I say that because, for instance, in a financial case, once you do the math, once you do the hard work, you can make the issues very anticlimactic, and it's hard to argue that black and white, right? And now that we have these factors under 9201, the hope, and I'm sure that Annapolis shares this hope, is that you're making these cases somewhat anticlimactic, that we know these factors, we're not going to argue variations of the Sanders factors. What we have, definitive factors that you are not to deviate from. Argue these 15 factors. If you want to spend part of the afternoon arguing within 16 and add about 10 other factors, that's on you. But it's these 15 factors that should enable any judge in Maryland to decide a case.
Okay. So are there some of these factors that may be weighed more heavily than others, that I don't want to say more important, but maybe, I mean, maybe that is the right word, that might be more important to lean on depending upon what your case looks like, what your client looks like, what their family looks like?
Yeah, it's always interesting. I mean, we could, I'm sure, point out five factors that we would consider generally the most important or the most critical. And then we get a case that walks through the door where it turns out that three other factors are actually much more important given those specific factual circumstances. But let's go ahead and do it. And in my opinion of the factors, and I don't know if you want to go through all 16 or at least the 15, but I would say of the factors, I'm going to read them out in my opinion. A child's stability and emotional security is one. The relationships with each parent and significant people is another. The parent's ability to communicate and co-parent, put a pin in that one. The location of the homes and how that affects the child's routine, it's another big one. And the child's age and preference, if appropriate. So of those five, I would consider the location of the homes and how it affects the child's routine as your baseline critical. I mean, that's going to be virtually critical in every case, right? Because it affects the day-to-day.
Okay, so let's morph back for a second to the old days when I first got started out. And the laws have certainly changed since then. But in those days when we were talking about getting ready for a custody case, and we look at this factor in terms of the location of homes and how that affects the child's routine. In those days, we told people not to leave, right? If you have two young kids at home and you are there with your spouse, don't leave the house. Because if you leave, especially if you got kids in school, you put your case in a difficult position, whereas you're the one that's trying to get those children, that child or those kids, to come and live at a new place, someplace that they haven't lived before. Whereas the parent who stays there, right, is more able to show, I can maintain the status quo, right? I mean, you with me so far? Okay, so now layer on top of that, that folks don't need to be separated to get divorced here in Maryland anymore. So now, doesn't this potentially cause significant harm to families who look to be heading down the custody route? In other words, you've got two parents, both of whom have lawyered up. Now they're getting ready for this custody case in which these factors have been articulated into law. And one of them, as you've properly identified, is the location of the houses and how that affects a child's routine. So both parents want primary physical custody, want to have the kids primarily reside with them. Why would either parent move out under this new law?
You know, David, this has come up for me recently in a handful of cases. And frankly, the short answer is that not much has changed in that general way of thinking, right? The family's castle remains just that. And any house thereafter is more of a fort rather than the castle, right? And that hasn't changed. In fact, I would go one step further to argue that the ability to establish and maintain a divorce case while living in the same house has only complicated this. I'm thankful that we codified these 15 to 16 factors into law. But that's a Band-Aid over the greater problem, which is the separation within the house. Because not only do you leave the custody questions open, because frankly, the only way to establish a custody still remains if there are different homes, we're juggling two different warring concepts here, and there's no good clean answer to date. And I appreciate these factors, but you know, I would also appreciate maybe this term coming up in January, we can get some clarity as to how do we deal with this very real situation that exposes people to real harm and potential flashpoints of domestic violence.
Yeah, I mean, that's the issue. Clearly, the legislature is looking to lay out a map for how to determine this sort of what's in the best interest of this child, these children, right? So, I mean, that's why this is now law, right? This is now a statute. They're looking to try to make a map for people to follow so judges can more easily make these determinations or at least have a map to make the determinations, right?
That's right.
Okay. So,
and a little bit more uniformity.
Yeah, but so isn't the irony in all of this that the statute may actually encourage more dispute, more debate, more fighting because neither one wants to leave the house and lose that edge?
Absolutely. I think that a lot of the recent changes we've seen to the law, whether it's the 6-month separation, whether it's the, you know, separation within the home, whether it's the demolishing of the grounds for divorce down to just, you know, no fault grounds. And now with this, I think that the idea is to simplify the process and make it more accessible. I think that we keep hearing this, but I think your intuition's correct, and this is what I've observed, is that the cases have been far more contentious as a result.
Okay. I don't want to beat this like a dead horse, as they say. And folks, we are going to put the factors in our show notes here, so you'll be able to look at those as you listen to this episode. I do want to ask you about this 16th factor, Chris, and tell us what that is and why it's there.
So the 16th factor is any other factor that the court considers appropriate in determining how best to serve the physical, developmental, and emotional needs of the child. Right? That's verbatim. I just read that off of the statute itself. I mean, can you come up with a more open-ended factor than that, David? I can't. But it's essentially, it's your kitchen sink, right? And forgive me, the exact number of factors in Sanders and Taylor, I think the last number I had was around upwards of 30 if you totaled them all together. And so I'm sure that you can go in to both of those cases and find some factors that you think help your case that aren't listed in the statute. And that's what it really comes down to, is because while these 15, the first 15 factors are going to be generally applicable to the population at large, every custody case has this unique entanglements and issues. And so that 16th factor is a way that, while acknowledging the desire for uniformity, it's a way that the legislature has allowed the court to still consider the particular needs of a child. Because ultimately, if you don't allow the court to consider the particularized needs of a child, then how can you say that the legislature has allowed the court to consider the best interests of the child? You know, it's failed at its job without that factor.
I hear that. And it also, again, so that there's no confusion, it just layers on another piece of subjectivity, doesn't it? I mean, I'm Judge Bullitt. I'm making a determination as the Jones versus Jones case. I've looked at these factors, but you know, there's something that irks me about this mother. There's something that bothers me. So I'm going to come up with something to get me where I want to go. I'm going to consider these factors, but there's something in my gut that tells me X or Y should happen. Doesn't that allow a judge, again, and I know we're trying to reduce subjectivity to a certain degree, but the fact of the matter is we're not really doing that, are we?
If you had, let's say, the Smith v. Smith case also came across, and you look at this and say, okay, you know, these are two parents that maybe they couldn't get along. Here are the factors. And it's a pretty down the middle. It's not terribly controversial. It's a fairly straightforward custody case. It's unfortunate. Maybe the lawyers didn't get along in all the ways that they should have. And so the case didn't settle, and it's in front of Judge Bullitt. But but in that case, you're comfortable. You could be equally comfortable in just resolving that case within the first 15 factors. And then you have case AVA, the same thing. Maybe you only needed 14 of the 15 factors. So I would assume that out of 10 cases, 7 of them will be able to be resolved within the first 15 factors. It is those last 3 that are high conflict that require the 16th factor that is your wild card. I don't know of anyone that's won the game of Uno without using a wild card, right? But in this instance, I think it's the release valve that's necessary.
Okay. And just briefly to touch on this, the factor that involves a child's age and preference, how much does that matter dependent upon the age or maturity of the child?
This is such a great question. And the answer itself, I do wish here on this factor, the age of the child was explained and expanded on a little bit more, right? Because you could have a case where a 12-year-old acts like a 16-year-old and a 16-year-old acts like a 7-year-old, right? And you talk about subjectivity. I suppose that the court is empowered to analyze that, but the factor just says simply the age of the child. It just says the age of the child. If the court says, okay, kid's 15 years old, you know, this is what I'm going to do. I'm not going to mandate this very, very specific arrangement. I'm just going to have it be somewhat more open because the kid has about 15 extracurricular activities each day of the week. And the kid's going to be driving in a year, so they'll be able to drive back and forth. I think that opens up some issues, and if I could be critical and so bold as to criticize the statute, that's kind of where I would.
I mean, logic tells you, common sense tells us that, you know, that a 15-year-old's preference, assuming that 15-year-old is an age-appropriate, mature 15-year-old, that child's preference is going to mean more than a 3-year-old that says, I want to be with mama or I want to be with daddy.
Yeah.
So let's shift a little bit to modification. So here's the scenario. The Joneses were divorced in 2020. There was a custody arrangement, and now that's not working for whatever reason. You can discuss the possible reasons for that. So now Mr. Jones is looking to modify that prior order or that prior agreement. Is it the same analysis? You just go to these factors, and this is what a court has to do, is look at these 15 factors plus one to make a determination? Or is there another hoop that the person who is trying to change that existing order has to jump through?
Yeah, so the legislature helped out a little bit here too, right? 9202. It's a new statute effective as of October 1, 2025, that is slotted in right after 9201, which we just talked about the factors, right? It outlines that the court may modify a child custody order or a visitation order if there's been a material change in circumstance since the last order and in a way that meets the best interest of the child. I'm paraphrasing, but that's essentially what it is. Now, that concept embodied within this new statute, 9202, just like those factors, is not a new concept. It is still the threshold that we have all operated on. It's still the magical language that we've all operated on. It is the idea that, is there a material change in circumstances from the last order? Meaning, since the last order is put in place, has something changed in a material way, not a superficial, but a material way that justifies changing that order? And how do we change that order in a way that meets the best interest of the child? And at that point, once you start to answer that question, you're going to turn the page backwards and go to 9201 and start going back through those factors.
Okay, what might be, I know there's a litany of possibilities, but what might be some common examples of a change in circumstances that would result in the court taking a look at the potential modification of an existing order?
So I'll use a couple. One is listed in 9202 itself, as if to provide us an example, right? As part B, it says the parent's proposal to relocate the residence of the parent or the child in a way that would cause physical custody to be impracticable constitutes a material change in circumstance. There was always a question in all of our cases in the past that had this issue of how far away is too far away to move in a way that causes a material change in circumstance. The statute doesn't really answer that question, but it does add a flavor which says that causes physical custody to be impracticable. And that outlines how you now need to essentially go back to 9201 and those factors to start doing the analysis. I would also say that you can look at the factors themselves to identify whether or not there's a material change. And this is all going to be new, so it's going to be up to your argument to the court. But items such as, you know, the ability to communicate and co-parent, that was one of the factors we talked about. And I think that right there, sure, the court custody order in place says that they need to, you know, communicate on all the issues, and you communicate through Our Family Wizard, right? And then you've got a situation where parent A, 6 months into the order, stops communicating via Our Family Wizard, starts communicating via text only, and is very combative. That is a situation where the court says, you know what? 9202 is triggered. Material change has occurred here because the parties are unable to communicate. They're essentially, one of the factors is failing here. That's how I would consider that analysis taking place.
Very briefly, because I'm sure there's a few of us lawyers here that are listening, what's the impact of this statute on lawyers who try these types of cases, who represent clients when it comes to either initial custody cases or potential modifications?
It identifies our ability to, you know, look at these cases and say, all right, this is we know for sure that if a material change has occurred, that we're making that change. We're doing the analysis under the prior factors. So again, it's moving past the arguability under the case law and putting it into the quote unquote uniform or lack of variability of a statute.
Okay. And if you're a parent who, let's just deal with a specific example because this is something that happens with regularity. You're a parent who says, you know, I got to move because of my job. You know, I got moved to X, Y, or Z. And this is going to upset the existing access schedule, right? And it may result in a modification. And I come to you and I say, you know, what do I do? I don't want to not see my kids. I'm worried that, you know, I have to move to Richmond to pick a place. And that's too far for me to be able to get the kids 7 nights out of 14 or 6 nights out of 14 during the school year. How do you work with that client in terms of trying to make sure that they don't face what could be a very restrictive access schedule?
Yeah, I mean, that's always tough, right? Even non-preferential traffic patterns can lead to causing a impracticable physical custody arrangement, right? Especially in this area. It's not the best and it's tough on parents. But at the end of the day, what you could do is start going through these factors, those 9201 factors. And again, it's not one of those where if you get 8 out of the 7, you win. 8 over the 7, rather. But you need to start building up how strong of a case you have, right? And yes, maybe the relocation will inevitably lead to a change in the physical custody schedule, thus requiring an analysis here. You use those other factors to your benefit and see if you can't get a situation that still is in the best interest of your child in a way that's not such a, what I would say, destructive to what was the original custody arrangement, or at least as far as the, you know, number of overnights, for instance, is concerned.
Calls for some creativity, right, on behalf of my lawyer's part in terms of trying to figure out how I can now maximize my time with my kids, despite the fact that I have to move, you know, 100 miles away or whatever it might be.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, right, all these, the Taylor and the Sanders factors were bred out of an understanding of the statute itself, right? And we now have a statute. So in 5, 10, 15 years' time, we're going to have new case law that is probably finding itself nestled within that factor number 16. And there's going to be case law that's really going to help us truly kind of define how we move forward on these custody cases.
Okay, so let me ask you this, and we've been talking for half an hour or so now, but if there's a couple of real, I hate to say soundbite, but that's the kind of society we live in now, takeaways for folks that are listening, tell me what those would be.
Yeah, in the last few years, the Maryland legislature has tried to implement a campaign of bringing in more uniformity to family law in Maryland. I think that this statute is the first real attempt to make custody cases more uniform in Maryland and have the bench employ less variability, less ambiguity, less vagaries, and rest within at least 15 primary factors with one open door factor, number 16. And it's a way that perhaps the cases that we present to judges are simply just that, more uniform and less variable.
Okay. And if folks, Chris, want to get a hold of you and discuss their potential case or what might be coming for them down the road, what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, they can give me a call right here at JGL, Joseph Green Walden Lake, at 240-399-7881, or give me an email. My profile and all my contact information is on our website, and I would be happy to talk about either any new custody issues or modification issues that rest within this new statute.
Chris, I want to thank you for your time. Folks out there who are listening, custody cases are a minefield where parents regularly, and I say regularly, do things that they ought not do. So if you're on the precipice, if you're looking at the potential for custody litigation, or just want some advice as to how to prepare for it, give Chris a call. I'm quite certain he can answer your questions. And as always, folks, thank you for joining us, and we'll see you next time or hear from you next time on JGL Law for You.